And we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with you this day. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. So busy week. Seems like things have been busy for a while now with these natural and unnatural disasters.
Yeah.
And we, in our relentless drive to bring you good news from all over the world, we're in a pig in heaven. Pig in mud, something like that.
All right. So, Mr. Parrish.
Yes.
You have a, did you want to talk about?
Oh, yes. I have a new job.
You got a new job.
Yeah, you know. After 35 years of living on the dole. Yes. No. I just want to throw it. I've taken a day job with a political campaign. And so, for the next few months anyway, I'm going to let Maria handle the city of Seattle commentary, because I'm going to help a woman named Diane Ferguson, who actually Mike also knows from their days at Scan TV. I'm going to help her try and win a seat on city council this year. So wish me luck in the campaign, but it does put me in a position where I am not a disinterested party in city politics. So, Maria, who is, will handle those commentaries, and people can just have this mental picture of me sitting in the seat next to her, pumping my fist and going, yeah, but not and, doing that verbally.
And trying really, really hard not to burst not in and say something.
Yeah, that'll
it's an exercise, exercise in self-control.
All right. So, and that lasts for how long? Until the elections?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Until successful or
successful or otherwise, yes.
All right.
Until either she loses or she doesn't.
Okay. All right. So you heard it here first, and won't hear of it for quite a while now. All right. So let's jump into local, and starting with the Seattle city attorney.
Yeah, City Attorney Pete Holmes this week filed a lawsuit in King County Superior Court to stop a vote on the tunnel. It was on Tuesday, the same day that folks from Protect Seattle Now turned in about 29,000 signatures to qualify a referendum for the ballot that would ask Seattleites if they want to repeal agreements that the city council made with the State Department of Transportation in order to get utility relocations, right-of-ways, et cetera, for construction of the tunnel. If Seattle voters vote to repeal those amendments, then, of course, that would stop the construction of the tunnel, or supposedly stop the construction of the tunnel. Holmes's argument for filing the lawsuit is that a referendum vote doesn't apply to administrative actions of city government, only to legislative policy actions. And he said that these agreements that the city made with the State Department of Transportation are really administrative actions, that the policy action, the legislative policy action, was the October 2009 memorandum issued by the city council selecting the tunnel as the preferred alternative for replacing the viaduct. And that since that's not referred to in the referendum, then the referendum as written is not legal and shouldn't go forward. So, and I think really what the reason why he filed the referendum, Holmes himself is not a big supporter of the tunnel, but the reason he filed the referendum is because he's under pressure from members of the city council and other members of city government, because once a referendum is up for vote, it puts a delay on the ordinances that are up for vote under that referendum. So it would mean delay of the tunnel. However, the tunnel's already waiting for the environmental impact statement to be finished, and that's not going to be finished until August, or possibly even September. So construction can't go forward until then anyway. So I don't see what the point of filing this lawsuit is.
So can I ask a clarifying question?
Sure.
Because, you know, obviously that lasted a long time, didn't it?
Yeah.
But this is, this is not commentary.
What's going on?
Yeah. Uh-huh. But the city council approved the agreements, right?
Uh-huh.
Isn't that a legislative why is Holmes saying that uh-huh. is not a legislative action?
Well, he's saying it's not a legislative action because he's looking at it in terms of what the agreements were about, not the actual way in which they were done. The way in which they were done, it was a vote of the city council, therefore it's legislative, right? However, he's saying they're just simple sort of house cleaning type agreements with the Department of Transportation over this bigger policy decision, which was to go with the tunnel. So that's where he gets his argument from. But it's a pretty, I don't know if the court's going to agree with him on that. I agree with the folks who filed the initiative that, these are in fact legislative agreements with the Department of Transportation over the construction of the tunnel.
And shortly thereafter, didn't Governor Gregoire jump in and say she agreed with Pete Holmes?
Oh, yeah. She said she agreed with Pete Holmes. And, of course, the governor's a big proponent of the tunnel, just like a lot of the Seattle business associations and the city council as well. And it really kind of ticks me off because Gregoire was hinting that, you know, we've already voted on the tunnel. The representatives of the people have taken a stand, so therefore the people must follow them, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. And that really ticks me off because, you know, we voted for the monorail. And then the city business community came back to us and said, oh, no, we got to vote again, and we got to vote again. We got to keep voting until we vote it down. Well, and here the residents of the city of Seattle already voted against the tunnel, and yet we get it anyway. Now we're trying to vote against it again, and they're telling us, no, shut up.
By the way, it wasn't just Gregoire. There was a press conference with Gregoire, with King County Executive Constantine,
yes,
who has not come out against the tunnel this publicly before.
Mm-hmm.
Several city council members, including Nick Licata, which might surprise some people.
Mm-hmm.
So there was really the whole array
really
of
unanimous on the city council.
Yeah,
yeah.
I think wasn't there one person on the city council?
Yeah, Mike O'Brien voted against it.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, mm-hmm. Let's move on from that. Department of Justice looks like they're going to set up shop in Seattle for a while.
Yeah, this week the Department of Justice announced it will formally investigate the Seattle Police Department. This comes after the preliminary investigation of the Seattle Police Department that started in February over civil rights violations. This relates to all of the stuff we've been talking about on the air here for the last year or two about different incidences in which members of the Seattle, the fine upstanding members of the Seattle Police Department have been caught doing things like beating people of color on tape, basically violating people's civil rights. And so now the Justice Department says that it's going to do a full investigation of the Seattle Police Department. It's going to also, it's the Civil Rights Division will also do a separate review of the facts in the shooting of John Williams to try to determine if his civil rights were violated as well, and if they can bring some kind of a suit against Officer Burke for violations of civil rights law in that instance as well.
All right. Well, let's move down to developments coming out of Olympia, starting with the Washington State Legislature.
Yeah, this week the Washington State Legislature approved a law to recognize same-sex unions that have been formalized in other states, which is just the first step in opening the door to same-sex marriage and domestic partnerships here in the state of Washington. So there's something to celebrate, at least one thing to celebrate coming out of the legislature this year.
All right.
Well, here's another thing. The medical marijuana dispensary bill that we've been talking about in recent weeks got through House Ways and Means by one vote this past week. So
just
it is
squeaked.
So it is three out of the four steps that it needs to get through. And now if the House approves it, it will go to the governor's desk for signature. So that one's moving along. The state Republican leadership of the House and Senate surprised everybody this week by calling for a tax increase. Now you may be thinking, now wait a minute, haven't they been, you know, not only they, but also the Democrats totally resistant to any revenue increases and in fact demanding that the shortfall in the budget be balanced entirely by cuts in the budget? Well, not exactly. You see, the state Republicans want to help fix the state budget by having higher taxes on tribes. That's right, on cigarettes, on gas, and on non-tribal lands. So what we can conclude from this, aside from the fact that they don't really mean it because, number one, they know Democrats wouldn't really do it, and number two, they probably couldn't get the two-thirds majority required by Tim Iman, is that they're philosophically okay with raising taxes as long as it's strictly on brown-colored people.
Yeah, or people that you can't send back to wherever they came from.
All right. Other developments in Olympia?
The DSHS this week. hammered people on Disability Lifeline again. You may remember we've been talking about Disability Lifeline in the context of the budget the last few weeks. Proposals right now are that one of the things they're going to try and do to balance the budget is eliminate entirely this cash stipend for people who are disabled and aren't eligible for federal benefits. In other words, people who are completely unable to work due to either physical or mental disability and don't have any other source of cash, that source of cash from the state is going to be removed from them. Well, DSHS has been doing it piece by piece anyway. There were cuts in 2010. There was another cut of 26% in January of 2011, 3 months ago. And this past week, there was another cut of, 21% in January. There was a cut of 26% this past week, effective April 1st. So less than a week's notice for people who rely on this money in order to survive. This is an order for DSHS to try and help the governor balance the budget for 2010. This isn't even going for the coming year in which they're expected to try and eliminate these cash stipends entirely. So, people who have no other options and are totally dependent on the state are getting treated very, very badly by the state.
All right. And, earlier this week, developments with the Disarm Now Plowshares.
Yeah, the folks who in fall of 2009 did a nonviolent direct action at the Bangor nuclear weapons plant in Kitsap County were sentenced in federal court on, I believe it was Monday. The five were sentenced to between 6 and 15 months of imprisonment, I should say. Ann Montgomery and Bill Bixel got the two lightest sentences. They're the two oldest of the defendants. I believe they're both in their 80s. Ann got 2 months prison, more months of home monitoring. Bill Bixel of Tacoma got 4 months imprisonment and another 6 months of home monitoring. Lynn Greenwald, 6 months in prison. She's from Tacoma. And then Susan Crane and Steve Kelly, who've done a number of these plowshares in the actions in the past, as has Ann Montgomery in different parts of the country. Susan and Steve both got 15 months and then 1 year of supervised release, which is to say probation for all five of them. So sentences that are pretty normal for plowshares type actions. They weren't as harsh as they could have been. Jackie Hudson, a woman who works with Ground Zero in Kitsap County and who was involved in a plowshares action in Colorado a few years ago. I think the folks involved in that action got 3 to 5 years. So this wasn't as harsh as it could have been, but still, especially for folks who are older activists who are in a couple of these cases not in very good health, still pretty severe sentences.
All right.
For nonviolent actions.
All right. And then finally, Dave Reichert having a problem with AARP.
Yeah. Speaking of older folks who are going to have trouble getting around, Dave Reichert, who really hasn't done a whole lot in his 8 years now in Congress.
How long has it been that long?
Yeah, it has. And he's really done nothing to distinguish himself. Well, he took his first strong step toward getting an identity this week when he was one of three Republican Congress people who issued a statement demanding that the IRS yank the nonprofit status of the American Association of Retired People, which is the single, I believe, largest lobby in the country and the largest membership organization in the country. Some 50 million Americans age 50 and older are members of AARP. And AARP was a very forceful advocate of Obama's health care reform, which, of course, the Republicans all despise. Now, the interesting thing about this is that AARP also, is one of the ways that it raises money for its membership empire, brands itself on a number of different, products. And one of those products, of course, for anybody who is familiar with AARP is their insurance policies. So they weren't exactly a disinterested party, but you know how this is any different from any number of organizations and corporations that lobby on behalf of legislation in which they have a direct financial interest is something that Reichert didn't really go into or try and explain, nor did any of the other Republicans involved. But
well, you could say any organization that lobbies has a financial interest in the outcome of the bills that they're lobbying for.
Well, of course.
Against.
Well, of course.
Particularly any organization that takes donations.
Well, particularly when it comes to tax laws, budgets, you know,
yeah.
IRS regulations, any of that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So Reichert, he hasn't said yet whether he's going to be running for re-election in 2012, but one way or another, either he's going to retire, in which case the AARP is going to remember him, I'm sure, or he's not going to retire, in which case the AARP is even more likely to remember him, I'm sure. So, not really a head scratching move on behalf of the good former sheriff.
All right. Moving on, update on the upcoming potential government shutdown.
Yeah, April 8th is the date by which Congress has to pass a continuing resolution to fund the government in 2011. This is something that's happened twice already, but seems less likely to happen this time because House Republicans are being very intransigent about demanding that a budget of cutbacks that they have drafted be the basis for any compromise. That budget, of course, excludes military spending. It excludes any kind of tax or revenue increases, and focuses its cuts entirely on very, very deep cuts in social services. The Democrats are balking at this, saying that they've already compromised on these, et cetera, et cetera. There may be some room for compromise in the next week, but frankly, since it's already the weekend of the previous week, they're running out of time to actually get the bills through Congress physically with the required periods for reading and so forth before the Friday deadline. So it's looking increasingly likely, like, even if they do reach a compromise, we're going to have at least a brief government shutdown, which, of course, would deny paychecks. It would deny VA health care. It would deny a lot of services to a lot of people for however long the shutdown lasts.
All right. And moving on, this week's economic news.
Yeah, you're probably waking up this morning to see headlines in your newspapers about how the job market is improving and that many, many more people got hired this month than in prior months, and that we've had steady hiring for, the statistic I saw was for the last 12 months. However, much of that hiring hasn't been enough to cover the number of people entering the job market who are coming of age, graduating from college or high school, who need to find jobs. So unemployment has not always been going down over the last 12 months. It's been going up and down and up and down and up and down. In addition, what the figures don't tell you up front, if you read through the article, you may see this in the middle or towards the end, is that a good one-third of the jobs that were created last month are only temporary jobs. They're temp workers, which means a lot of businesses, particularly in the service industry, are hiring people provisionally with the thought that they may not need them as permanent workers. They're only hiring them for now.
It also means they're not very well paying jobs.
Yes. In addition, that means they tend to be much lower paying, as Job said, but they also don't come with benefits right away. A lot of temp workers don't get benefits until they're considered permanent employees or have been employed for a certain amount of time. And in addition, those workers may not be working a full-time schedule either. The average work week is still at about 34 hours, which means a lot of people are underemployed working only part-time jobs. So a lot of these new jobs are not full-time jobs. And then I also want to talk, too, is that we had some other statistics this week about the housing market, how the house prices are still falling. It's been 6 months now since the expiration of the first-time home buyer credit, the actual complete expiration of the home buyer credit for people who managed to get managed to qualify for it and then have their house closed. It takes a certain amount of time between when you qualify for it, get the loan, and get the house closed, et cetera. It's been a full 6 months, and in those 6 months, every single month has shown a continuing decline in housing prices and in home sales, according to the Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Home Price Index. So this has got people worried that we're entering a double-dip housing market recession. Well, I want to just point out that it really was only the first-time home buyer credit, which became the all home buyer credit, because everybody could qualify when they extended it, the third time, that really prevented it from being one long single housing market recession. So I don't really see this as a double dip recession. It's really one long continuing recession that was briefly interrupted by a little bit of government stimulus. It sort of put some backing to Obama's claim that really the government needs to help the economy, because boy, the government was the only thing that's been keeping the housing market afloat for much of last year.
All right. And moving on briefly, Gallup poll.
Yeah, Gallup having its annual environmental poll the last month, and for the first time since the late 1990s, only a minority of Americans, 49%, think global warming has already begun to impact the planet. That's down sharply from more than 60% 3 years ago, and the amount of people who worry a great deal or a fair amount about climate change or global warming down from 67 to 51% over that period of time. Now, this coincides exactly with the Democratic strategy and the strategy of a lot of big green environmental groups that was implemented around the time Obama came into office in late 2008, early 2009, to de-emphasize the talk of climate change and global warming and instead talk up green jobs. Well, we're seeing what the problem with that is now. There's a couple of them. First of all, Republicans and big oil have been very consistent in talking about it's a fraud, it's a fraud, it's a fraud. And for the last couple, 3 years, there hasn't really been any consistent talk from leadership in this country that contradicts those claims. That's one problem. The second problem is that green jobs, well, that sounds very nice, but it's not something that's really urgent. Again, talk about reducing dependency on foreign oil, which is another of the talking points from that strategy. That's also very nice, but it's something that politicians have been talking about for 50 years and nothing has changed. So it's not really urgent, whereas, you know, civilization and the future of our species on the planet is under dire threat. That is urgent. And, you know, you had two-thirds of Americans thinking that that was the case 3 years ago. That other one-third probably isn't going to be reached, and two-thirds should be enough to take action. But instead, nothing has happened. There's been not even any cap-and-trade legislation. There's been no international agreements. In fact, the U.S. has been in the way of some of those international agreements. And now we're seeing Americans thinking, well, it might not have been that urgent after all.
All right, moving on to international, starting with the Ivory Coast.
Yeah, after a number of concerns over the last several weeks about the incumbent president Laurent Gbagbo refusing to give up power after he lost an election in November to Alassane Ouattara,
Ouattara,
that how it's pronounced? well, he's not listening, so. he's got other problems right now because, Ouattara had been spending the last, couple of months trying to round up support from the international community for finding a way to be able to take power after he won the election, was not able to find a whole lot of that power past rhetorical support from people like Obama and various European leaders. And so over the past 5 days, he and his supporters have taken on a military offensive to try and take the country. Have basically swept through most of the country in the first 4 days and now have surrounded the presidential palace in Abidjan, which is not the capital, but it's the commercial center and largest city in the country. Unfortunately, a lot of civilians have been killed. We're seeing reports this morning of some 800 civilians killed in one small town on western Ivory Coast alone earlier this week. And so it looks like things are happening by force rather than through negotiation because some of the Middle Eastern countries where people did care, the international community didn't really care enough to try and intervene diplomatically in Ivory Coast nearly as assertively as they could have.
And we just want to point out that Ouattara did his best to try to have a peaceful democratic changeover of government in the Ivory Coast, and he held out as long as he could before having to take the road of military intervention instead.
Yeah. All right. Japan.
Yeah, in Japan, I saw some photos this week. It's really the first time we've been able to see them that were taken about a week ago by an unmanned aerial drone of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, or what's left of the reactors there. And from looking at those photos, you really can see that it is impossible to tell. It is impossible to tell just looking at it from the air what is in amongst all of that rubble. And so you get a really good, clear sense that when the Japanese government says we are just making guesses, we don't know for sure, that really they are just making guesses. They don't know for sure if the water they're pouring into these reactors is reaching anything. They don't know what is underneath all that rubble. And they really don't know what's happening inside. You really cannot see because it literally is, particularly reactors number one and number three and number four, the three that exploded. It really is just a pile of rubble. You really cannot see anything under those mounds of concrete. And so It's very interesting because here in the United States, we keep getting reassurances that, oh, they're getting it under control. They're pretty sure that this is happening or that is happening.
And it's really dropped out of the news the last couple of weeks.
It really has. Those reassurances have made it, as Job was talking about global warming, I was thinking the same thing about this reactor emergency in Japan. It really has done the same thing. Those reassurances have meant that the media can now focus on other things. And so I find it interesting. You have to go to the British press to get any real decent news. The British press interviewed the UN chief nuclear inspector, the director general of the International Atomic Energy Association. Yukiya Amano. He told the New York Times this week that Japanese statements, quote, asserting that the nuclear cores and fuel ponds were covered with water were essentially inferences based on how much seawater had been poured in and analysis of the radioactive steam emerging from the plant, end quote. He's basically saying they're just guessing. They think that they're pouring in water, they're measuring steam coming out, they're hoping it's hitting the target. And he said instruments are still, quote unquote, knocked out, which means they have no way of knowing what's going on in there or what's happening at all. And he said, quote, there are areas we don't have information, end quote. And it's very clear you can't see inside reactor number four. That's the one building that didn't explode. Its big external shell is still there, and you literally cannot see what's inside. It's too radioactive to go inside. Meanwhile, Richard Leahy, the former head of reactor safety research at General Electric when the company built the reactors at Fukushima, told the UK newspaper The Independent that one of the reactors appears to have melted through the bottom of its containment vessel. That would be the one in unit number two. And the Japanese media has continued to report that underground tunnels linking all the reactors are flooded with water and that the radiation levels in that water are continuing to increase, not just radioactive iodine, but cesium as well, which means the rupture of the reactor cores. And that because the radiation levels are continuing to increase, it means that it is a continuing leak coming from the reactor cores. So it's very clear to me that we're not getting the information that the rest of the world is getting on it, and that the situation is much, much worse than we're being led to believe.
All right. That leaves us a minute for Libya.
Yeah. Guardian report yesterday that President Obama has authorized both covert actions and weapon sales to the rebels. That, of course, has not been confirmed by the White House and runs directly counter to statements by Department of Defense Secretary Robert Gates saying that they would not sell weapons to the rebels or provide weapons to the rebels, and statements by Obama himself that we would not put boots on the ground. Of course, if you give weapons to the rebels, you also need to put advisors on the ground in order to train them with those weapons. So it looks like, not to really anybody's surprise, the mission in Libya is expanding. It is becoming more of our taking one side in a civil war, and the basic stalemate that's happening on the ground reinforces the idea that we're going to be in this for the longer haul.
And of course, one of the rebel in quotes leaders had lived in outside of Langley, Virginia for 20 plus years.
Shocked.
Naturally.
I'm shocked about that.
Naturally, or we wouldn't be supporting them, right?
Events.
Yeah, this week is coming up is a national week full of labor events to try and put pressure both on the federal government and the various states where worker rights are being attacked and budget cutbacks are affecting working people. In Washington State, that means here in King County, there will be a major rally on Monday at 5:30 at Martin Luther King Park at MLK Way South and Walker. And then on Friday will be the big rally down in Olympia starting at noon at the state capitol. And there is actually a whole week's worth of events, and you can find that list at www.mlkclc, that's short for Martin Luther King County Central Labor Committee, mlkclc.org.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is available online at www.eatthestate.org. Don't necessarily believe everything that was posted yesterday, just because, you know, it was yesterday. But in general, we have commentary and comics and all kinds of cool things on local, national, and international news. www.eatthestate.org.